time to listen to the interviews from last week's Island Life. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on what people on Waiheke are thinking and doing. It's brought to you by Placemakers every Saturday morning from 10 till 12. One of the most significant events last week on Waiheke was the sale of the Waiheke Week to Liz Waters, owner of the Golf News. Last Saturday on Island Life, I spoke to Liz Waters about her new acquisition. I also talked to Greg Treadwell, a former Golf News editor and now a journalist lecturer at AUT, with his take on the sale. And I talked to the opinionated Islanders Alan Knight and Mark James, who also had some ideas about the Waiheke Week, as well as talking about sculpture on the golf. As well as that, I talked to Steve the Butcher, Don McKenzie from Rotary, and Rosalie from the Library. But first, Liz Waters. Yes, indeed, you're on Waiheke Radio, and as I said, we're going to have a chat to Liz Waters. She's the editor of the Golf News, and we've seen some big changes in the local media scene over the last week with, one paper gone and a new one taking its place. We've seen the demise of the Waiheke Week, and at the moment a fairly similar looking Waiheke Weekender taking its place, and Liz is the editor of both. So Liz, is this all about your ambitions to become the next Rupert Murdoch or Kerry Packer?
Good morning, Chris. Well, actually I kind of got that reputation back when I first bought Golf News back about a dozen years ago, when I was still running the Devonport Flagstaff, which I'd started. So for about three years, I was actually editor of both the Devonport Flagstaff and the Waiheke and Golf News on Waiheke. So this is kind of amusing. But
so, I mean, one of the things that people have talked about over the last few years, since we've had the introduction of the Waiheke Week, you know, because the marketplace has been around for, what, about 10 years? Golf News, of course, a long tradition going back many, many years on the island, and outseeing a number of other players who've come and gone over the years. And then we had the introduction of the Waiheke Week, and, you know, for 4 years people have been saying, well, is there room for three papers on the island? And it seems that there is.
I think it certainly is a little odd to have three newspapers going for so long, all claiming to provide news. I mean, different functions. I think this will be something of a rationalisation. I mean, for Golf News, and I've been part of Golf News since just 1979, 1980. I'm a journalist by background. And at this moment, we're getting back to doing the visitor publications that we've done right from the beginning. You know, there's always been an annual, which has always aimed to provide people with just the background information. I mean, we have a lot of features in Golf News, but there's always room for... I mean, there's just... People say, how do you find enough news on Waiheke? Actually, there's always enough news. Sometimes you run out of the steam to actually go and get it all, but actually there's an enormous amount here. Everybody's got a story. It's a really extraordinary community. For the first 10 years I was here, I was interviewing people whose families had been here probably for 100 years, some of them, just as the pioneering families came to their end. So I met some really extraordinary people then. So
are we going to see a shift in balance then of what's in the Golf News and what's in the Weekender, with some of those more, you know, longer features shifting towards the latter?
I think it'll be much as we did with the monthly Islander, which we were doing in from about 1999 through to 2004. The Islander was a mix of what you need to know to enjoy living here, the background, so that you know what that funny little building on the way down to the wharf is, and you know the true and depth and significance of Rangihua. The Weekender, which is of course weekly, we will just be providing everybody with an opportunity to get really set up for their weekends. I mean, the object of the Weekender is to have it so that people get set up and really enjoy their Waiheke weekend. To some extent, obviously that's visitors. To some extent it's obviously real estate and lifestyle and wine and things. But to some extent it's just those of us who live and work here actually living the lifestyle that we live in, but we don't necessarily enjoy everything that's to be had here.
I was re-watching in preparation for this. I re-watched a clip that was filmed for the Media 7 show on TV about the three papers on Waiheke. And you know, what was interesting there was, I mean, you know, obviously they took a slanted look at it. They went out and talked to people on the street and said, you know, what do you like about the papers? And you know, a lot of it came back to the Gulf News. And you know, there was one character in particular that asked, well, you know, why the Gulf News? And he said, well, it's got the dirt track results in it. And that's an element of the community that hasn't been in the Waiheke Week. So when you're talking about reflecting island lifestyle and the way that we like to live, are we going to see that kind of stuff in the Weekender?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, we'll have all the sports, what's coming up at the weekend, and I mean, we obviously rely on the clubs for that, but we've got a pretty good setup to get that as well. I mean, the dirt track is a huge part of the island community. I mean, I think you ignore the fact that this is a really diverse, I mean, you know, we rattle off the word, but it really is diverse. And you know, the older people, the sports people, having an incredibly good time. I mean, why would you not have it there? You know, I mean, there's various cultural things. There's an enormous amount to make sure that we've included it. You know, and I think when you said that people, I didn't see the Channel 7 clip, but I mean, if people have an affection for Gulf News, I think it is that. We have a sort of mission statement which says that we'll have the name of everybody on Waiheke in the paper at least once every 3 years. And that's everybody. You know, it's not just the right people, but it's everybody.
So how are you going to avoid one, well, the new one, the Weekender, cannibalising the Gulf News? You know, if you're using, I presume you'll be using many of the same staff, writers, your advertising crew and so on. So how, if, you know, if there is a shift there, what impact does that have on the Gulf News, which is, you know, the gold standard, really, in local media?
I think we pioneered it with the Islander, and it actually added depth. You know, it was a different focus. It is a slightly different demographic. Waiheke Islanders, and I've been thinking about it for a while, although it all happened really quickly. And I actually see them as being really quite separate. We will keep a lot of the look for the different demographic of the Waiheke Weekender will look like its predecessor. And there's nothing in Gulf News that's going to change. And in fact, it will have a different stable of both writers and even production people.
Okay, so you are
without overdoing it.
Yeah. Okay. So, you know, for advertisers, will they be able to come along and say, well, look, you know, let's get a blanket coverage across both papers, package deals, that kind of thing?
I'm sure we will, yes. You know, I mean, advertisers have totally specific needs. This just enables me to put the entire package in front of people. Mm. And that's pretty important. Yeah.
Now, I suppose the other aspect of running two papers is the sustainability of doing that staff-wise. I mean, you're currently editor of both papers. You've written a great deal of the Waiheke Weekender, and you're also, you know, you're a regular contributor writing into the Gulf News as well. How do you keep that up? You know, are there enough people on the island who are capable of doing the work to keep two papers going?
Oh, totally. Yes. I mean, the editor job is as big as, or as executive as you want to make it. At this moment, it's myself, but that won't necessarily last for more than 2 weeks. So that's not a given. I'm not in some sort of editorship ego trip. Mm. It's actually, and I'm up for having two extraordinarily good newspapers. Yeah. That are both, I mean, equally, I mean, I'm never going to mess with Gulf News. It's the perfect formula. It's the same one that I had when I started the Flagstaff in Devonport. At that stage, I'd already been in Gulf News for 12 years. It's really, I mean, I know what the formula is. It changes slightly, but in a way that doesn't mess with people's certainties about what's in it, and that's not going to change now.
Now, in that same clip I was referring to before, you talked about a turf war on Waiheke, and I suppose you must be feeling a degree of satisfaction that you've won out.
I think time will tell.
Yes, well done, Liz, and congratulations on the launch of the paper. You know, it is nice to see independent local media on the island, so we congratulate you on that, and all the best for the new venture.
Thank you, Chris.
It's Liz Waters, editor of Waiheke Weekender and the Gulf News. Reid Troopwell is a former editor of the Gulf News and now lectures in journalism at AUT. He joined me on Island Life to share his views on the sale of the Waiheke Week to Liz Waters. Now, we just heard from Liz Waters, editor of the Gulf News and the Waiheke Weekender. Now, to take a bit of a broader look, really, at the Waiheke media scene and what's going on, because we've had a lot of change over the last few years, I've asked Greg Treadwell to join me in the studio. Now, Greg is a former editor of the Gulf News and now, what should we say, a leading academic in the field of journalism with a special interest in community media working at AUT. How are you, Greg?
I'm very well, Chris. Thank you very much for having me.
Okay, so now you've obviously got a close interest in the Waiheke media scene.
Yep.
You've been involved with it for many years and you've also got a broader interest in community media. So we've seen, how significant is this change over that we've seen with the shift from the Waiheke Week to the Weekender?
Oh, well, what it is it's the end of what Lizzie once called on TV the turf wars with the arrival of the Waiheke Week, which prompted an incredible strengthening from the marketplace and a very determined approach to their campaign on the island. And, of course, Gulf News had to respond as well. And for a long time there were these three all very vibrant newspapers working very hard for the community, but also working very hard for the advertising dollar, which of course was split horribly between all of them. So this is going to breathe a big sigh of relief into the market in some ways. A lot of businesses are going to be under less pressure from media salespeople, quite frankly, and the money's just going to go a little bit further. And after all, like it or not, it's that money that's going to keep these really important news organisations going. With the advent of Waiheke Radio going from strength to strength, and various websites, including, of course, Waihekepedia, you've got to say that the island, the next phase of the island's media history is well supplied.
Mm. Now, of course, with that advertising war, which was really, I suppose, at the basis of it, it was the Gulf News that took the kicking there, wasn't it? Because they just weren't the right format for aren't the right format for real estate.
Well, of course, Gulf News printed on 1960s A.B. Dix for many, many years on the lower side of Ocean View Road in Onaroa Village in what's now the new fish and chip shop. For many years, we turned over these couple of hero printers, turned over these old A.B. Dix, and they come out black and white, and that was absolutely fine. The community didn't want it. Colour, they said, no, we can't afford colour. But then, of course, I think it was always going to happen, and when it happened, everybody said, oh, yeah, this was always going to happen. And newspapers on the island decided to print in town with colour in a tabloid format, and so the advertisers were against their own will, if you like, drawn to that, and Gulf News had to go to be printed in town as well. But, of course, Gulf News was caught in that perhaps unenviable position in some ways of having a format that all the readers just love, and the advertisers sometimes are a little bit sceptical over, particularly with some of the high-end advertising like real estate.
One of the things that I asked Liz when I was talking to her earlier was that, you know, many over the last 4 or 5 years, people have been saying, is there enough room on the island for three papers? And it seems the answer is yes, there is.
There isn't room for three papers trying to do the same thing. And this is why this is a strategic move from Gulf News, and a very clever one that fills about the only gap left in the Waiheke media market, which is for a publication tilted pretty much solely at the visitors. I'm not saying it won't be an interesting read for anybody who picks it up on the ferry. I'm sure it will, because Gulf News has got a long history of quite significant, to be honest, and often profound features about island life, history, characters, politics. And those features are going to start making their appearance in a much easier format, if you like, in the tabloid. And it'll be a good read for everybody. But that's the only bit of the market that wasn't saturated, and that's the visitors looking for a bit of colourful information and history about the island.
Mm. So another thing I talked to her about was that obviously you would expect there'd be a lot of crossover in staff, that, you know, writers working across both papers, advertising packages and so on, which I suppose, as you say, will help out those businesses around the place. But how do you retain colour? I mean, does this happen in other communities where one organisation is running two outlets, two papers?
Yeah, it's not that uncommon, to be honest. Every publication. Pretty much every newspaper in the country has got some other publication they do, whether it's an annual roundup of summer events, or perhaps, as Gulf News has done on numerous occasions, it's a features-based magazine. This is just another one in a long line of magazines that Gulf News has put out over and above its weekly journal of record, if you like, for the island. It's not that unusual, and I think it's a smart move. I do think so.
So this really could have gone any way, couldn't it? I mean, the other significant thing, of course, is that we've had Fairfax take over the marketplace.
Indeed, that's big news too. You know, Fairfax is shedding journalists all over Australia, and it's buying the Waiheke marketplace.
And they've closed down a number of their other New Zealand publications, haven't they?
Absolutely, and there are some, as I understand it, some on rocky territory at the moment, sort of poised to go either way. Look, newspaper readership around the world is falling. I mean, in just about every other place except Waiheke, where it just seems to continue to grow and grow and grow.
But, you know, the Fairfax, I mean, you don't get to be a company that big by just going, oh, we just feel like buying a paper on Waiheke. You know, they would have looked into it. They would have seen the fact that there were three papers there. They wouldn't have had wind that one of them was going to go.
No, they backed them. They backed the marketplace, that's for sure. And I'm sort of quite pleased to see that not much has changed about the marketplace, to be honest. I guess I'd expected a Fairfaxization of it, perhaps not as far as putting a suburban newspaper's masthead on it or anything like that, but I had expected to see some of that larger corporate influence, and I haven't, and I'm really pleased about that. I think the marketplace is what the marketplace is, and it's very, very local and passionate about itself.
Mm. Do you think that the model of the Waiheke Week was wrong for Waiheke?
When they first came to the island, I did ask Mervyn if he'd got the measure of the community, and he felt confident that he had, and his response was, you know, understandably, was, well, wait and see. And I think perhaps they didn't quite pick the readership right. I don't think they managed to stay slightly aloof, and you can't do that on Waiheke. Yeah,
but in some ways they may have actually been a precursor or paved the way for some of the lifestyle changes we've seen on the island. It could have maybe they make those people feel more welcome.
Oh, absolutely. The Waiheke has always been a community of disparate communities, and there's all sorts of people in Waiheke, and there's a market for a newspaper like the Waiheke Week. But I think that just think they judge something not quite right, and in the end they just didn't have the support, and I think that was at both an editorial and an advertising level.
Mm. Now, if you were in charge of the world, what would the Waiheke Weekender end up looking like? What kind of form would it take?
If I was going to run the Waiheke Weekender?
Yeah.
Oh, I'd like to see lots of deep and colourful features. We have a large visitor market on the island. It's important to the island, and to have that well served by a bright and colourful tabloid format paper, I think there's plenty of room for it. And I would go steady as she goes, having had a look at the first issue. It's well pitched, and I can see it's got a lot of potential to grow. It'll be interesting. It gives, what I love about these sorts of newspapers is that they give local feature writers an opportunity to get into the nitty-gritty of the community, you know, and meet all the wonderful people on Waiheke, get profiled through newspapers like this.
Mm, it has the potential, I suppose, to become more of a weekly magazine, doesn't it? And maybe take the form of some of those, you know, magazine lifestyle supplements, feature supplements that come with the big daily papers.
Yeah, but instead of being about fashion or about art, it's about our community, and that's a wonderful thing.
Mm, good stuff. Well, Greg, thank you for your...
Hey, welcome. We can make this a little regular Waiheke Media Watch.
Yeah, well, I think we probably do need to. It's shifting ground, isn't it? And there's certainly a lot going on.
Yeah, well, I think the next phase of the history of the Waiheke Media, which has always been rich and colourful, is going to be rich and colourful.
And any predictions? What do you think will be the next big change? I mean, I certainly didn't see Fairfax coming, and I certainly didn't see this.
Yeah. No, that's right. That's the thing about the Waiheke media. They've come and gone over the resident, the good oil, the Waihekian, and there were dozens before that. Yeah. I think this will be a long and fairly stable phase, to be honest.
Okay, thank you very much, Greg. Thanks, Tripwell. What is your official title up there, Greg, at AUT? No, well, what do I call you? World expert in community media?
Yeah, No, I'm just a humble lecturer.
Yeah, but doing a great job of it.
Thanks, Chris.
Okay, cheers. Each week on Island Life, we're joined by Steve Hill from the Village Butchery to talk about food. This week, he gives his opinions of all of those TV chefs. And it's time to talk to Steve Hill from the Village Butchery, our regular host or our regular guest talking about food. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning.
Okay, now today we're talking about TV cooking shows. There's a heap of them out there. They've become very popular over the last few years. So, one of the things I'd like to know, Steve, is of all of the different cooks or presenters out there, which ones do you rate? Who do you think's got it?
If I had to mention one, it would be Rick Stein.
Yep. What is it about him that... I mean, he's got that kind of laconic style, I suppose, hasn't he?
But he just enjoys food. There's no flash, there's no dash, there's no cash. You know, he just does it for the sheer pleasure of eating. There's no sort of hidden agenda. He's not chasing Michelin stars or whatever. He just does it, and the simpler he does it, the better it gets.
So when you watch a cooking show, are you watching for recipes, for personality, for location? What is it that draws you in?
Ideas, basically. A lot of the modern ones are reinventing things, and they're trying to sell it you as a brand new product, when in actual fact, it's been around for donkey's years, basically. But if they shout loud and it's all camera angles and we make a four-course meal in 20 minutes, purely by the magic of television, we don't know that it takes a week to make that one program. They're just, how can you say, some oversell themselves as a person rather than what they're actually doing.
There's been a shift, hasn't there? I mean, a lot of the earlier cooking shows were really about recipes. You know, even the Jamie Oliver ones was, how do you cook this? And sure, you had to put up with him riding around on his scooter and being annoying, but there was a recipe in there. Now, something like Gordon Ramsay isn't about recipes at all. It's about the restaurant trade. It's about being a chef.
It's about Gordon Ramsay staying in business, basically. I mean, he's a marketable thing. I mean, you watch him and he's working 18 hours a day in his restaurant, but he's got 20 of them. And he's making TV programs on four continents, writing books and articles in magazines, newspapers. When does he actually do his 18 hours a day in his restaurant? Jury's out on that one. I haven't got him. There is something in there about him that I like, but He knocks other guys for going on Ready, Steady, Cook and that sort of thing. But he's doing exactly the same thing, but in a different situation.
What do you think about his food ideas? I mean, he seems to be into keep it simple, keep it local.
Well, anybody who cooks knows what's grown, what's in season, what's best, what's fresh, what's there is, if you're eating strawberries, you're at Wimbledon, it's June. If you're eating strawberries in Waiheke in June, they come from California.
Yeah.
Mistakenly, I bought some kiwi fruit the other day, and they came from Italy. And I just, I mean, I just thought kiwi fruit, they're coming from Tipuki, you know. And I scratched the label off before I peeled them, and it's like, it comes from Italy.
It's all wrong. You know? Okay, so you rate Rick Stein. Your jury's out on Gordon Ramsay. Let's run through some of the others. Jamie Oliver.
I like him, actually. He can be an annoying prat, but what he's doing with the food, especially with the school food, what the kids are eating, I think that is really, really precious. That is important to actually wean the kids off the McDonald's and actually taste something. I mean, you see him, he does those experiments and he puts up vegetables and what is this? And the kids have no idea what it is.
It's frightening, that, isn't it? When they don't recognise common vegetables. Now, what's her name? Nigella. What about her?
Oh, she's difficult. She makes food sexy. She's a sexy-looking lass, but she actually makes it easy. Just do this. All you have to do is think about it and put it together. Simple, but I can watch her. It's like, I don't know, sitting by a log fire drinking a 24-year-old malt whiskey. It's smooth, it's sensual, it's... it's just nice and homely.
Yeah,
I think that's the thing. In a different vein, obviously, Rick Stein is a bit more manly, but he has that same... he draws you in.
Yeah, it's a very kind of comfortable kind of, you know, feeling, isn't it? Now, what about that New Zealand pair, the guys who run Logan Brown and Wellington, I can't remember their names, who get around the country. Have you seen them?
I catch them occasionally. The New Zealand cooking programs I find are a bit wooden, but they are very practical. I just get a little bit annoyed when we use this particular brand. So it's an advertorial rather than... it is a cooking program, but it's also sponsored by the ingredients that you use, which is, I feel it a bit awkward.
And finally, I suppose, I can never remember these people's names. Peter Matthias, isn't it? You know, with the red
Peter
hair.
If she didn't put on that affected French accent, I could quite get on with her. She is passionate about the food she does, but it's just that I lived in Paris and I had a restaurant in Paris, and then we get this Clouseau sort of French English sort of thing, and that just annoys me. It's kind of a personality, you know. You meet somebody, you either like them, you don't like them, or we need some time to work them out and find out what their actual point of view is.
Yeah.
Gordon Ramsay for me is a smack in the head. He's quite good at what he does. Rick Stein is more honest and basic. Peter Matthias, I think she's great, but just that once you become personality sort of thing. Somebody starts pulling strings to make it marketable and sell the advertising bit, and that doesn't seem quite right.
Does it have an impact in the shop? So, you know, Gordon Ramsay goes on and cooks up a particular cut of meat, and the next day everyone's in the shop wanting that cut of meat?
It does, and the biggest problem we've got is because they're international and they're different cuts of meat, they've got different names. And a lot of people say, I've got this recipe, and it says we want this. And what they're explaining to me is completely different than what it says. So what I say now is, bring in the picture. And I can say, oh, this is the bit you want. Go away and do it.
Yep.
You know?
So you ever get people coming in and say, oh, look, that thing that Jamie Oliver made last night, I want that.
Well, we do, but again... I mean, I'm English and I'm used to English style cuts of meat, but you go to Australia, New Zealand, America, Europe, they're cutting up the same animals, but there are different name, different way of cutting it. But once you've isolated that particular muscle or whatever it is that they want, and I've got a picture of it, I can see it, then I can recognise it, no matter what name it goes by, and say, oh, it's that bit. So we can do that.
Well, there we go, the rundown on the TV hosts. So it seems like you are a bit of a fan of the TV cooking shows.
I watch them all the time.
Yeah.
Because even if I'm watching somebody that I don't particularly like, I might learn something. And at the end of the day, it's just sucking in ideas, information. You know, somebody's done something different than what I would do. And I think, oh, that's better than what I do. So, you know, I will modify what I do to suit, you know, my style, but borrow a bit from somebody else, you know. It's stealing bits from everybody.
Good stuff. Steve Hill from The Village Butcher, one of our great supporters here at Waiheke Radio. You're on Island Life. The first Saturday of each month, we're joined on Island Life by the opinionated islanders Alan Knight and Alex Stone. Alex was off sailing a boat this month, so stepping into his place was Mark James. Been an eventful week in Waiheke politics and events and issues, and here to talk about that, as they are every month, are our opinionated islanders. Welcome along, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so we've got a couple of things to talk about this morning. The obviously the biannual, is it biannual or biennial? If it's every 2 years.
I give up. Biannual, I think.
Okay, biannual. We'll say the biannual sculpture on the golf exhibition, and of course we've got the demise of the Waiheke Week and the rise of the Waiheke Weekender. So shall we start off there?
Okay. Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So now it would be fair to say, Alan, that over the last few years you've been vociferous in your opinions on the Waiheke Week.
Well, yes. I mean, the ever since the Week Link first slithered out onto the market 3 or 4 years ago, I've found it to be a very annoying newspaper, and have said so on numerous occasions. It was a very belligerent paper. It never held back in its editorial approach that of aspects like, oh, isn't it unfair there have to be poor people on the island and complaining about things when folks like us want to just develop the place. And The paper always took the view that the island needed more development, whereas I've always taken the view the island's already had way too much. Simple difference of opinion between myself and the editor, in which he's wrong and I'm right. But you told me about when all the rumours of the changeover came last week. You popped round and told me. I think I only stopped laughing this morning. Because I suppose he can take comfort in the fact that the editor was running around when the paper first started saying, there's only room for two newspapers on this island. Well, he was absolutely right.
So what's your take on it, Mark?
Well, the Waiheke Week was formed on the assumption that the island was changing, that it was changing from a very liberal, hippie-oriented 1970s to a very conservative, developer-oriented, let's say, 2010. And I'm glad to see that they foundered on that assumption.
Absolutely, yep.
Yeah, there have been rumors for some time that the Waiheke Week was pretty clear that they must have been losing money and that it was a big drain on somebody's resources. I don't know if there were party resources behind it or if it was just the owners themselves that kept pouring money into it, but there had to be a limit to it one way or another. And there were rumors that if National won the elections last year, that they would sort of declare victory and quietly fold their tents and go away. Maybe that's what happened.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have picked it. I really didn't see it. I mean, I did think that they were going to go. I thought at Christmas when they didn't come out for a couple of weeks, you know, and you're a paper aimed at the visitor market in a lot of ways and being on the ferries.
Yes, the fact that they deliberately chose to ignore that busiest time of the year and go on holiday did seem a very very telling moment that, yes, they don't really seem terribly serious about this anymore. Mm. And great news for the Gulf News, of course. I mean, not only having sort of won it, but actually bought the thing out as well and using it as an advertising supplement for all the sort of advertising that they can't normally do in the Gulf News proper. The only thing, though, that I will say in support of the Waiheke Week is that whilst I may have disagreed with a lot of what they stood for, their journalistic standards, if you could actually find a story in there, were usually fairly high. And more importantly, they were the only publication on the island to point the finger at our most recent addition to the community board and say, we have a problem here. This guy is a wrong'un. Whereas the other two papers were too cowardly to ever raise any questions about this particular chap. The Waiheke Week, on the other hand, had the courage to go full out and say, yeah, this is, something's not right here. We've made a mistake.
And that's something that we're not going to see in the new paper.
Unfortunately, we won't, so no, it'll be up to me on the radio.
Yeah. Although we may. I mean, there is talk, of course, that they want to put features in there and make that, you know, maybe shift it more in that direction. And so maybe we will get some deeper examination of local issues in there, which might be quite nice.
I wouldn't hold my breath on anything too controversial. Both the remaining papers have not exactly showed much backbone over the last few years when it comes to anything. They're too scared of upsetting their advertisers, and I think that is a great shame.
Mm. Now, have you had a chance to have a look through the Weekender, the new format?
Absolutely, it took me all of 2 minutes. We were just sitting outside looking at it. One of the most interesting things about it was when I saw that they'd actually managed to get a copy straight out this week, was to actually look for the masthead. And where is it? Well, oh, page
it's
7?
It's buried on, yeah, it's page 9 or something like that. There is absolutely no indication in the Weekender as to what the Weekender is. There is an indication in the Gulf News as to what the Weekender is. But the Weekender itself doesn't seem to announce what just happened to it, except that all of the email addresses for contacting the Weekender end in waihikigulfnews.co.nz. That is the only clue we have. But the Weekender is called, you know, the Gulf News Lifestyle Property and Weekend Guide. So I think that tells you that there's not going to be much in the way of editorial content here. It's going to be mainly property advertising. Well, that's what it always was anyway, but this time it's sort of front and center.
Mm. And in those turf wars, you know, I talked with Greg Troopwell about this earlier, that was really where the Gulf News took a kicking because they couldn't compete in terms of real estate advertising.
Well, yeah, given the format of the paper, it's, the larger sort of tabloid-sized papers with the colour printing were always going to have an advantage there. But then again, the Gulf News has held its preeminent place as the main sort of forum for discussion of issues and also in classified advertising. So it's and plus, of course, it is a genuine newspaper. You've actually got to take $2 out of your pocket and buy the thing every week rather than pick it up at the ferry terminal and have it shoved in your letterbox.
The classified advertising is a good point, actually. Someone was remarking to me the other day that, you know, we've got this new website, Y-Trade, which is going, you know, Waiheke kind of trading on the internet. But in a lot of ways, maybe the mistake they've made is that their competition isn't TradeMe. their competition is the Gulf News.
Mm.
And, you know, because that's where people know if you've got something to buy or sell, it's cheap and easy, and it's always in there.
Well, I must admit, I had a look at Y-Trade last week, and there really is virtually nothing on there.
Mm.
It's a great idea. Well, good on them for trying it, but I think they're really going to have to work to build it up a little bit.
They may yet pull it off. This is the kind of thing that sometimes grows by viral marketing, and you know, people tell other people, and then it snowballs, but they will have to get that ball rolling.
But I mean, the idea of selling stuff online through these kind of auction sites is something that we're all now incredibly used to. And so there's no reason why it shouldn't be a huge success if they keep pushing at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it could succeed. I mean, what I like about it is it's bringing together a very, you know, a small community with global technology. And it'd be nice if that could work out for them, I think.
But getting back to the newspapers, I'm sorry I missed listening to Liz Waters and to Greg Treadwell earlier on. I was down at the market, so I couldn't listen to it. I don't know what their take on it was, but I'm sure I'll hear it later on. My hope for the future of the Gulf News is that they do manage to get a decent editor back, because I think Simon was a great loss. Greg Treadwell, of course, was an even greater loss. When he was editing the paper, it was a serious local newspaper. And I think if they can find somebody of Greg's calibre to take over, then there's a great future ahead for the Gulf News.
Well, certainly it can't go on as it is now. We've got Liz being the editor of both papers, and she's written most of the Waiheke Weekender. And, you know, and she's also contributing writing into the Gulf News. And you just can't keep that up.
Yeah. I mean, there must be some journalists and editors around who want a job.
Well, I asked her that, actually. I asked her whether that is a problem in itself, you know. Is the island, you know, we've talked about whether the island can sustain three papers. Can the island sustain, are there enough journalists, are there enough people with those skills to carry through all of these publications?
Oh, absolutely. On an island like this?
Well, yeah. we're an intellectual island, after all. I mean, look at this radio station.
Yeah. Oh, look at Mark's piece in the Gulf News this
week.
Yeah,
a very thoughtful piece in there about Obama and what may or may not happen there.
Well, it'll be interesting to see whether it elicits any letters to the editor next week.
Yeah, well, I think that's, you know, the letters to the editor, I mean, they're in the Gulf News, I think, are another attraction. You know, they're kind of horrifying, but they're...
they are sometimes horrifying. Yes, I mean, the one in this week's paper about the swimming pool was absolutely gross. For those guys that run it, I really feel for them. That is disgusting, but I'd say don't hold your breath waiting for any parents to put their hands up and say, oh, yeah, that was my kid. Because, strangely enough, you know, whenever we have young people behaving like that, these kids never have parents. Because you'll never get a parent going, oh, yeah, it was my kid. He's a terrible kid. Awful. Well, badly brought up, badly behaved. Just the kind of kid who'd go and vomit and put broken glass in a swimming pool.
I think there was a, you know, we've been talking about journalism and how the Waiheke Week did follow up on stuff. Now, that letter to me seemed to be crying out for someone to do some investigation, because
yes,
there are a couple of things that he said in there which, if they're, you know, if it's true, are very serious. Now, he said something about waiting in vain for the police. Now, if I was a journalist, I'd be on there and saying, okay, so does that mean you actually rang the police and they didn't turn up? You know, because if that's what he's saying, well, that's a big issue.
Look, the police have revenue gathering to do. They don't have time to go out and deal with crime. Be fair. The police are simply a branch of the Inland Revenue these days. And expecting them to actually go and sort of deal with unruly teenagers, I think, is unreasonable.
Right, now let's take a look at Sculpture on the Gulf, the other big event on the island. Now, love it or hate it, it is a big deal. I went around it yesterday morning and about 9 o'clock, and it was very, very busy. There were a lot of people in there, and they've been just coming in their droves from Auckland.
It will always be successful from that point of view, because it is such a lovely walk, you know. You could put something like dog turds on it, and it would still draw the crowds, because it's just such a lovely walk.
Oh. It is a fantastic...
Don't suggest it. Next year somebody will.
There was one.
That's the point.
Not this year. It was last time, wasn't it? There was the dog
turd. Two times ago, yeah.
It was
this enormous concrete dog turd, and yeah, well...
What I would like to know, though, I mean, they've made me go around the damn thing twice now. I haven't gone this year because it's just... sends my blood pressure too high. On both occasions that I've been in the past, I've finished the walk hot, bothered, and wanting to punch the sculptors if I could find them. And I think it's a question of the emperor's new clothes. I really would be the one to stand up and go, it's all rubbish. If I thought for a moment that these sculptors were actually sitting around beforehand going, okay, what can we get away with this year? What will the organisers of this... What would it take to actually make them go, hang on a minute, you're being silly. Ah, you caught us out. But no, it's like, oh, well, I'm going to do something that, you know, re-examines man's relationship with... And you look and it's a stuffed wolverine sandwiched between two paving stones. They're taking the piss. They've got to be.
There is a fair bit of re-examination of men's relationship with blah, 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 isn't there, Mark?
Yes, on and on it goes.
Yeah, there certainly is. And let me make a quote here. Take a quote out of Paul Radford's Flotsam. One thing I particularly strive for is an absence of any specific meaning. All right. I want the work to be enigmatic and mysterious, not loaded with applied significance. In this stripped-back way, the piece attains its own kind of beauty.
Now, I can't see the photograph from where I'm sitting, but let me guess. It's a doll's head shoved down a Wellington... Oh, no, it's a boat on a plinth. All right. Okay.
And that was... Actually, that was one I thought kind of worked, because, you know, part of public sculpture is about, you know, location and impact, and that one I thought did, because it kind of evokes some kind of the Easter Island thing, and it's, you know, it's linked to Waiheke because it's about boats and it's on the coast and stuff. And
all about boats. I mean, you know, there's that flotsam thing that consists of a balsam boat frame with a bunch of seaweed in it, and, you know, oh well, it's about global warming. Okay, fine, you know. Oh,
of course it is, yes.
One of the things I noticed about the exhibition this time was that, in comparison to the past, that things just aren't of the same scale. You know, in the past you had works which kind of made an impact and worked within their location, and this seems to be a lot smaller and a lot less significant. And there's a piece there, I mean, you'd blink and you'd miss them. And they're almost, you know, we talked about the location, they're overwhelmed by their location.
Well, I think, you know, on occasions there have been sculptures there that if you saw them in their correct context, usually in the foyer of some great big corporation run by vulgar pimp businessmen, you'd sort of think, okay, yeah, that probably fits. But out on Church Bay, it just seems out of place.
Mm. What ones did strike you, Mark?
Oh, the half-full, half-empty glass. I think that was, to say it struck me might be a bit of a compliment, but, you know, the idea of this sort of, it was like the door that they put on there last time, you know, that sort of right in the middle of the walkway. There was a door that somebody spent $85 at Placemakers and painted white and planted in the middle of the walkway. Oh yes, well, it symbolizes our inclusion and exclusion from nature. Okay. And this was the same thing. You've got this piece of glass just sitting in the middle of the walkway, and inside the glass is a hole. So, so you have...
I'm so glad I haven't seen this.
Oh, yeah. it's that kind of thing. I should read you what they...
Oh, yes, please do. Let's hear what it says.
Okay. Half glass appeals to our human desire to question, frame, organize, and solve and resolve. It toys with the inherent contradiction of a glass that is half empty, but is also a glass half full. Defying all technical limits for cutting and toughening glass, yeah, right,
mm-hmm.
The work rises from the ground, poised, elegant, apparently fragile and thin, yet also robust and firmly anchored. Half glass is both transparent and reflective, a chameleon. It swings between mirror and lens, frame and content. Sorry, I can't continue.
And that is fatuous nonsense.
And
anyone taken in by that is an idiot, as far as I'm concerned.
It's great reading those, because you don't have to satirize them at all.
No, you don't.
Presented it
just as it is.
The thing is that they're all presented as if they were the artists themselves who wrote these things, but they are all so identical that it had to be someone else.
Mm.
Either that, or there's one of those sort of art blither generators, like the postmodernist generator that you've got on the internet, where you, it will just come up with a slab of postmodern boilerplate for you at random, just throwing words together, and it sounds like a university lecturer holding forth. I suggest that what they've got is a program that throws together random thoughts and words to explain these ludicrous things. And but something that I really remember, I think it was the very first sculpture on the Gulf. I went walking up there and I took my dogs with me. And my old dog, Bonzo, was walking along the path, and we came across the winning entry that year, which was basically a stainless steel box with a puddle on top of it. Oh, right.
It did make noise and vibrate.
No, it didn't that day.
Oh.
it was just a it was a stainless steel box with a puddle on top of it. I thought it was an electrical substation until I realised it was the winning work of art. And I was standing there bemused for a while, but my dog was not fooled. He took one look at it and went and cocked his leg against it. Basically, for me, summing up the entire experience in one masterful squirt.
Yeah, one of the things that took me about the exhibition was that, you know, one of the things I like about some of the pieces is the craft and the engineering in it. And there is a piece called, I think, Trig, and it's about Trig stations or something like that. And as you said, Alan, I mean, it would fit nicely in the foyer of a large corporation. But it is beautifully engineered. You know, it's got these kind of weather vane bits on top, and they're balanced, and it's really nice. But there's other ones in there, and I was looking at them, and I thought, it's a bit of shoddy work going on here, you know.
Well, I think with a lot of these guys, it's like they leave it until the last minute. They're all sort of busy posing in whatever cafes that sculptors go to, and it's like, oh my God, I've got to come up with something for sculpture on the Gulf. I know, I'll do a 6-foot-tall garden gnome wrapped in bacon. Yeah, that'll work. And
if only.
We'll dial up that website and we'll get a nice big slab of boilerplate about what it all means.
There's a couple of pieces in there, actually, and when you look at the original concept drawings and then look at what's arrived, that I am sure that the organisers of the exhibition went, oh.
Well, those eggs, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah, the photograph in the catalogue of the eggs, and what was that called?
This one evokes eggs.
At home, it's called.
Yep.
It evokes being at home and migrating birds and all that kind of stuff. And if you look at the photograph in the catalog, they're rather pretty. They're like huge Fabergé eggs. And then you go there, and they're like huge Easter eggs.
They're just plain. I mean, and you know, presumably the artists themselves they don't actually make the aluminium powder coated balls. They get someone in a factory, someone to do that. And yeah, there's nothing to them. And I'm sure that the organiser has just gone, oh, that's not what we thought we were getting. It's a very strange exhibition this year.
Well, I'd like to think you're right. I'm not sure the organisers had that much of an idea of, you know, as long as the guff surrounding the work of art is appropriate. They don't really care what the work of art
exactly.
is.
Exactly.
Now, just to round this all up and kind of, I suppose, to come back in a circle, of course, we've seen a lot of coverage of the sculpture in the Gulf in the papers. How do you rate that coverage? How's that gone?
I found that the coverage of it was almost as annoying as going around the actual thing. I would generally get one paragraph in and just give up in disgust. I know they had a lot of stuff about it, but I just couldn't be bothered reading about it.
What about you, Mark?
I'm afraid I'm in the same position. You know, when I'm reading a newspaper, I've got better things to read than that.
Mm. I mean, what I'm finding about it is that, you know, I think universally, everyone I've talked to has said, yes, there's some things in there I like, but it's not at the standard that it has been in the past. Now, I haven't read that. You know, we've got art columns in our papers, and they're not saying it.
Well, I think there was one letter last week's Gulf News saying this really is a lot of empty, meaningless rubbish sitting up there. And, oh, and let's hope we don't get lumbered with another great piece of deteriorating garbage strewn down the hillside that's been purchased with our rates money.
Yes, I was commenting to someone yesterday when I was going around, saying, I wonder which one the community board will buy this year. And I just, if the community board are listening, can I put up my hand and say, not the diving board?
If the community board are listening, don't buy any of those fatuous pieces of nonsense. Spend our money on something more useful.
Here we go. Opinionated Islanders, Mark James, Alan Knight, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Chris.
It was a blazingly hot day on Sunday at Onitangi and a great success for the Onitangi Beach Races organised by Waiheke Rotary. The day before the races, the president of Waiheke Rotary, Don McKenzie, joined us to talk about what happens to the funds that they raise. You'll be aware, or you should be aware, of course, that the Onitangi Beach Races are on tomorrow, Sunday, February the 8th, and this is an annual event, a great Waiheke event, and one that we look forward to every year, and we're particularly excited this year because Waiheke Radio are going to be broadcasting live. Our very first outside broadcast will be there from the first race at 10 o'clock. Now, as well as being a great day out, this is a really key event for a lot of organisations on the community because it's a massive fundraiser organised by Waiheke Rotary. And Don McKenzie, who's acting president of Waiheke Rotary, is here with us. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Chris, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about the Onitangi Beach Races, which is an event that's been going, well, under the aegis of the Rotary Club since 1998, but actually it goes back 100 years. And in 1924, the races were cancelled because it was thought that the locals were gambling far too much and there was far too much wild living going on in Waiheke, so the authorities cancelled the races. But they were re-established again in 1983 by Keith Hobb. Now, people will remember Keith Hobb, who rang McGinty's down at the 7th Avenue end of Onitangi Beach. And Keith had a famous racehorse called McGinty. And so Keith called his pub McGinty's. Well, that ran on for 10 years and then stopped again, probably because Keith left the island. And then the Rotary Club picked it up again in 98. So we've been involved for 11 years now. This is our 11th year in running the beach races. I have to say that the Rotary Club is the we orchestrate the whole thing, but there are a whole lot of people in there that make it happen. Some really good sponsors: Golf News, Fuller's, SeaLink, and lots of wonderful local people that have helped us make this a real family fun day, because that's what it's intended to be. Yes, we need to raise some money. And why do we need to raise money? Well, in order to spend money on the island with those causes that we think are really
imperative. Yeah, well, I mean, you were saying before that, you know, in the 20s, there was a fear that people were gambling too much. But now, of course, you're right into the game of encouraging as much gambling as possible.
Absolutely, we are. And so what we want actually to do, we want people to buy their race packs, $20, and you buy your race pack when you get onto the beach. And the race pack has in it some tote tickets with randomly assigned numbers. And with each race, and there are nine races, horse races and tractor races, nine races. And if your number comes in as the winner, you can go back to the tote and collect $5. So actually you could, you know, get back some of your $20 that you've paid on the race pack.
So this works. You're randomly given a number of one of the entrants in the race, aren't you?
That's right. That's right. And the riders and the horses, they wear bibs. And if you see number six coming in, go and collect your $5. And if you get several number sixes in, you could just about pay for your pack. Yeah.
So you raise quite a deal of money out of this, of course, and you're selling food and so on. Now, what's all of this used for?
Well, we make all sorts of donations to various groups. We've given to the adult literacy effort on the island. Sea Scouts have got a boat from us in recent times. Of course, the Christmas voucher scheme for those who are in need. We spent $7,000 last year on that. Youth groups, they got a table, tennis table over. We've given some help to the Morrow Hall, the Arts Theatre Summer School, and we published a book on retirement last year, just what people have access to.
appearance seminar we help fund in association with the Jesse Dean Trust and so on. So those are the sorts of things that the money goes to, and of course various community groups are able to approach Rotary and say, well, can you give us a hand? And that's the sort of thing that we do, yeah.
So what kind of groups, I mean, you've named a few of the people you did help out there, but do you find that, you know, there's a great deal of need, a lot of groups are coming to you throughout the year saying, look, you know, we need this, we need that?
Oh yeah, there's always a good stream of folk, and it's contacts in the community, and of course one has to sort of work on the priorities, really. You have to make some judgments about where the money goes and the value that will accrue as a result of the giving. For example, if you take adult literacy, for example, you know jolly well that there's a group who, with a little bit of extra support, will make a huge difference to other people's lives by enabling folk to become more literate, more numerate, able to get a job and that kind of thing, become more computer-wise. So those are the sorts of things that we really focus on. Now, I do want to say that one of the centrepieces of our beach races tomorrow is the tug of war. Now, there are about 20 teams, 8 people in a team, and so the heavyweights will be pulling off for charity, really, and they have the opportunity to win about $1,000. So the winning team will get $500, and then Rotary will donate an additional $500 for the charity that team names. Now, there are teams in there for Westpac rescue helicopters, for the hospice, for Living Without Violence, for the SPCA, for the Coast Guards, for Friends of the Street, for the skate parks, St. John's, those sorts of groups. So there we go. All those groups could benefit by the winning heavyweights tomorrow by pulling against their mates. Actually, the winning team, all they get is a keg of beer from Waiheke Breweries. Thank you, Waiheke Breweries. And they will get their keg of beer, but the money goes to the charity that they nominate. So you can see we make money to spin money around, Chris.
Yeah, no, it's a very, very good venture. When you head into the coming year and the funds that you raise from this, do you set kind of priorities or a particular theme when you're deciding, you know, or earmark particular projects for what's coming up?
I guess we do focus to a degree on youth and potential. One of the programs that Rotary runs is the Rotary Youth Leadership Award. Now, that is a program for 20 to 25-year-olds, and they go off for a week's camp on Rangitoto Motusapu. And the army are there, and they run this sort of 4 weeks program. But it's not just a physical program; it's a program in emotional development and intellectual development as well. And of course, people on those sorts of programs meet folk from all around the Auckland region, develop networks, and those folk are the citizens of the future. Yep, that's and another program that we're really interested in looking at this year. We haven't quite got it all together yet, is the Rotary Youth Drivers Awareness, and that's targeted at young people, 15, 17-year-olds, in managing defensive driving, handling vehicles carefully, being aware of the dangers and safety aspects of driving and so on. So those are the sorts of things. So we're keen on youth potential development and those things which help this island, this community, to hang together. Naturally, we focus mainly on island issues, although we do have an international responsibility as well. There's the World Community Service Program. Last year, we gave a deal of money to a program called Interplast, which is where a number of surgeons and medical staff travel to the islands of the Pacific and perform surgery there for the alleviation of things like cleft palate and hair lip and things like that. This year we have given $1,000 to the emergency flood relief in Fiji, which again is one island community to another, because we all know living on this island that we are a little bit vulnerable. We all do have to hang together. We all are to a degree of pioneering spirit, and we know how other island communities have to deal with the vagaries of nature. So we feel a sense of kinship with Fiji, and a disaster like that could hit Waiheke, probably not so much in floods, but fire or whatever it is, sea rescues and so on. Those are the things that we're conscious of. So we do have an international thing as well, but primarily, though, 90% of our funds raised is going to the island community here.
Great. Okay. And tomorrow, of course, people can put all their serious thoughts behind them and just enjoy the day.
Bring their sun hats, sunglasses, sunblock. One thing I just would like to say in conclusion, Chris, is we're really focused on safety. When the horses are running, when the tractors are racing, we would like people to get out of the water. I know people are bound to want to go and have a dip. But when the races are on, it's really, really important that folk get out of the water just in case the horses veer off into the water, and we don't want anybody to... It's got to be a happy day for everybody. No injuries, please. Please take notice of all the warning signs. Take notice of all the instructions given over the PA and the notices that are about. Don't litter the beach, because Onitangi Beach is one of our prized possessions and it belongs to all of us, so... Please be tidy little Kiwis. That'd be much appreciated.
Great. Thanks very much, Don. It's always a pleasure talking to Rosalie from the Waiheke Library. She joined me on Island Life last week to talk about some of the latest books that she's read. Waiheke Library, of course, situated over the courtyard here, and artworks just over the way from us, and Rosalie's here to talk about some new books and some new events at the library. How are you this morning?
Oh, excellent. Good morning, everyone. It's a wonderful Waiheke morning. Just glorious.
And well, that's because you've got air conditioning in the library.
Yes, well, we had to wait a long, long time for it. But
I'll tell you what, you'll be waiting a hang of a lot longer for it to be in here. it is, yeah, it's very sticky in here. So anyway, so if people get along to the luxuriously cool Waiheke Library, yes. What have you got in there?
Well, I'm talking about books that I've read first off, and the first one is one of my favourite artists, Graham Sidney, and there's a lot of artistic people in Waiheke who will love this book. It looks at first appearance like a coffee table book, as does my other one that I'm going to tell you about, but it's so exquisitely photographed, because I thought, Graham Sidney, he's a painter, he lives in Dunedin, okay, he's used to cold and winter time, but nobody could paint in Antarctica. You're quite right. He photographs, but his artistic eye comes out in the photographs. They're just so beautiful. I've seen images of Antarctica several times before, but these are amazing. And it's that blue-white and the black-on-white with the rocks and the sliver of white. And I noticed, you know, there was one photo where there was a sliver of white and the gold of the dawn. And I thought, oh, how did that get taken? And it was Castle Rock close to midnight. And, of course, midnight, it's still sunlight, you know. And it was just this bouncing off, and it was just wonderful. It's he was staying at Scott Base and in the Artists in the Antarctic program, and he's really rewarded the government with that whole idea. It's a wonderful book, so keep an eye out for it. White Silence, which I think is a very appropriate name, by Graham Sidney. And another one that looks like a coffee table book but is far more is The Painted Garden in New Zealand Art. Seem to be on the artist spec this morning, don't I? And this is by Christopher Johnston. And with our Chris here, you'll be easily able to remember the name. Christopher Johnston and The Painted Garden in New Zealand Art. And I immediately thought of Stoddart and Karl Moorn, and I thought, oh, this will be interesting, and I started flicking through it and reading things, and in the end I took it home and I read it cover to cover. And I wouldn't have thought it was the book that you did that with, but it was so interesting, and it was very easy to read, and the scholarly research is evident but not overwhelming. It starts in the 1840s when the Europeans came, so it makes no pretensions to go back further. And it does, however, start off with one of the early shots is a Maori garden with potatoes. And, of course, the potatoes were something that Cook had given to the Maori, and they learned to grow them, and of course then in the missionary gardens and so on, right up to the present day, to the magnificent Karl Moorn paintings. So that's The Painted Garden in New Zealand Art by Christopher Johnston. It runs from three sections virtually, 1830 to 1860. It even shows Martha King, who's one of our first botanical women painters. Actually, I think it's probably one of the first botanical paintings, a gloxinia, because she arrived in 1840. Then it goes into early modern, 1890 to 1940, and then contemporary, 1970 to 2008. And absolutely brilliant Pamela Wolfe flower studies, and as I said earlier, the Karl Moorn works, which I love. And then something totally different. Do you remember mnemonics for learning things at school, Chris?
Yeah, I remember a few things. There were some rhymes about the months and how many
30 days has September, that sort of thing. Absolutely brilliant. And I before E, except after C. Well, that's the title of a book which I found very interesting. And you can't have it at the moment, Chris, because, or anyone else, until I bring it back, because I'm not quite finished it. But it's written by Judy Parkinson, and it's all these mnemonics that a lot of us knew. I'm quite a bit older than Chris, and we certainly had a lot to remember, but they certainly did help. Like Roy Gabiv and other ones to remember the planets, and what were the rocky planets, and what were the air planets. So this book, if it's in the library, it'll be at 153.14 Dewey system, but it's
now,
one of the new
only
books.
Only a librarian would reel off a
Dewey number. Well, there's a few people out there who know how the system works, but you're quite right. But just ask us and we'll find it for you. But I suspect that once the word gets out about it, because it's one of those dip into books to find out mnemonics for various things, I suspect it'll be quite popular for a wee while. As I say, it just came in the other day and I grabbed it, and I'm really enjoying it.
Good stuff. And you've got some new event encouraging people into reading and into books.
Yes, and on Tuesday at 10 o'clock we always have story time. And this has been an ongoing thing, but it doesn't suit everybody at that time. We've often had requests to have another story time. So our Tuesday story time is still continuing because it's wonderful and very, very popular, and a great way for some of the young mums to meet other young mums and children and so on. So now we're starting a new one. We did our first one last week on Thursday at 10 o'clock and it went very well. So for young mums out there, or dads, or both, come along to the library for the junior story time Tuesday at 10 o'clock and Thursday at 10 o'clock. The Thursday one I'll actually be doing, and I haven't done story time for ages, and I used to do it and I used to love it, and a lot of singing and a lot of movement as well as the stories.
Good stuff.
It lasts half an hour. Yes, the same as the Tuesday 10.
Oh, great. That's a great event and a good thing to get your kids along to. Well, thank you very much, Rosalie, for joining us.
A pleasure.
Okay, you can scoot off back to the cool of the library.
Enjoy weather.
You've been listening to a replay of the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show about Waiheke people, issues and events. Island Life is brought to you by Placemakers every Saturday morning from 10 till 12. And these interviews are available for download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Mm-hmm.